Hi, this is Jovi.
This is Charlie.
And you're listening to...
This is Bed Crime Stories.
Sorry, you totally
threw me I did.
You totally threw me off. Like, I like was about to say it, and then I saw Charlie doing this dance. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to let her go.
Let my freak
it.
Flag fly, my friend.
I didn't want to interrupt it. I feel like if I would have said it too, it would have ruined the moment. So,
you know... I just, you know, nothing but love, but you're kind of right. It would have just completely thrown me off my game and I would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes I gotta let you shine, Charlie. I gotta let you shine.
You're just gonna let me take it. Oh, and by the way, this is a weekly true crime podcast. We pour ourselves a drink and we take turns telling each other the stories that keep us up at night. And for the first time in a long time, I have a drink again.
Yes, she does. Mm-hmm. Yes, she does. And it has been a long time since you've had a drink.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have water. You had that one episode of me drinking.
Exactly.
Exactly. And now I have water.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Jovi's rehydrating from her last episode of drinking, and I'm done hydrating, and I'm just filling all of my pores with red wine.
Yes. But you know, that's the blood of Christ. So, you know.
Exactly. And that's what we call balance.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. No. Real quick, I know we have a huge show ahead of us.
Yes.
But before we jump in, I just want to ask, how was your vacation last week?
It was good. And you know what's funny? And okay, so I worked the whole time I was on the cruise, but it was the most stress-free work week ever. Like, I was still busy, but.
Yeah,
because of my view and because the second I logged off, I had a drink in my hand and it was perfect. Like I still got a massage. I still went to see a show. I still ate good. I still drank a whole lot. Like,
you ate good in the neighborhood.
I did. And like, we had a nice little schedule where I would wake up, I would get my work shit together. I'd start doing some emails. Then at about 8 o'clock, I'd you know, go on a quick break, go downstairs go upstairs to the Lido, if you will, have some breakfast, have some coffee. And then I'd go back to the room and my fiance would go and do his thing. And we met up after I logged out of work. It was perfect.
That was
amazing. And honestly, you know what this does for me? This makes me realize that even when I don't have PTO and I want to go on a cruise, guess what? I can.
You can.
But no, it was great. I always have fun when I go on a cruise. This ship is my least favorite ship. It's because it's old. Like, it's old.
Yeah.
And you could tell it's old. Like, it needs a dry dock soon so they could fix a lot of things,
spruce it up a little bit.
We had an aft facing balcony, which was awesome, but the room itself, the lampshade on one of the end tables was broken. The thing on the bottom of the couch that became a bed was off the hinge,
so it's just like those little things that it just needs a touch up.
And it's you know, you could replace those, or you could kind of rig it to where it doesn't look broken.
Yeah.
I don't know. It bothered me because my favorite ship of Carnival's is actually older than the one we were on, and you would never know it. So,
because they've zhuzhed it a little bit.
Yeah. And it's better taken care of. So,
yeah.
But yeah, but no, it was good times. Good times.
Yeah. Good times. Good
times. Thank you for asking.
You're very welcome. I wanted to make sure that we got that out of the way.
Yes.
Sorry.
And I took plenty of pictures of alcohol for the Instagram. So
for Instagram, yes.
Yes.
Because I will tell y'all, like, it is getting harder and harder. I have been, I do know about you. I've just been going out less. I've just been, even when I do go out, it's like maybe a cocktail. I don't know, man. Turning 40 this year really changed the way that I cocktail. Yep.
Absolutely.
So, like,
it's a whole new world. It is a whole new world.
Yep. For you and me.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of teased a little bit last week that I was the last episode that we posted that I was going to take the time that you were on vacation to do something epic.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. A megasode, if you story. Will.
A megasode. Well, as I was writing the episode that I'm going to start today, I realized that it was so long that it was longer than our longest episode we've ever put out. And I was only like halfway through.
Oh, yeah.
So I messaged Jovi and I was like, what do you think about a two-part episode? Because holy bleep, right? So this is going to be a two-part episode. What you're listening to right now is part one. Mm-hmm. So next week we'll be releasing part two. And it kind of worked out nice because next week is Turkey Day.
Yes.
And when we're talking about the present time that we are speaking about here, if you're a listener listening to us in the future, it is currently the week before Thanksgiving.
Yes.
So we're not really going to be recording next week because we have Thanksgiving things that need to be done. So it just kind of honestly worked out pretty well.
It really did. Perfect timing.
So I'm going to go ahead and jump into part one of the next 2 weeks bed crime story. So we've been doing this podcast for 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. I think not the last episode, maybe two episodes ago, was our 3 year anniversary episode.
Right.
And for 3 years of doing this podcast, I think I've talked about doing the story. And I have been like agonizing over sitting down and writing the story because I still don't know if I wrote down and did it the way that I would want to do it. But the other day at work, there was a couple of us that were chatting, and you know how like you kind of like subject associate, like we kind of just got on yes. one of those things where we were like talking about this and it like went to left field and went back to right field and was like going all over the place.
Yes.
And somebody said something and I was like, oh, it's like my favorite thing to talk about. I could talk about that for hours without preparing, without notes, and just talk. I know way more about that subject than I should know about. And this person like kind of asked me a couple of questions and I'm like throwing out dates and I knew like all this stuff. And all of a sudden I went back to my desk and looked it all up because I wanted to make sure I was right. And I was, I fact checked myself and my facts were correct. But in looking certain things up, I realized that this Saturday, November 18th is the 45th anniversary of the climax of the story that I am about to tell you.
I totally know what you're doing now.
And this Saturday, November 18th, will mark 45 years since the Jonestown Massacre.
Yes! 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 You know, I've only been telling you to do this for 3 years. Yeah. And like jabbing at you. And mm-hmm. Oh my God, I'm so excited.
Now so this is a very special Charlie's Cult Corner.
Yes! Oh my God, this is going to be fantastic.
I'm very excited.
Oh, I'm so excited. See, even Molly's excited.
Yes, even the dog's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So obviously, after 3 years of talking about it, I am now going to tell you the saga of Jim Jones, the People's Temple, and the tragedy at Jonestown.
Yes.
So my sources for this story first are this book. It is called The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. It is by an author named Jeff Gwynn. It is thick.
Yeah, it is.
This is like my Jonestown Bible. Referred back to it a lot today while I was taking additional notes. I have like earmarks and highlights. I'm such an idiot.
So basically what's going to happen is Charlie is going to school us. This isn't a podcast at this point. This is a class.
You know, I'm going to do my best.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do my best. So, So this is my main source material, The Road to Jonestown by Jeff Gwynn. Obviously, Wikipedia, because Wikipedia, without you, we would be nothing.
True facts.
Also pulled some, like, interesting factoids from All That's Interesting from an article from the Associated Press that was actually written by a survivor.
Nice.
History.com and an article in The Rolling Stone.
Awesome.
So I'm going to start where the People's Temple started, and that is with its leader, Jim Jones.
Let's do it.
So Jim Jones was born James Warren Jones in Crete, Indiana. His birthday is May 13th, 1931. Jim's father was a disabled World War II veteran. He suffered terrible breathing. He had really bad breathing issues, had really bad like lung issues stemming from a chemical weapons attack in the war. And because of the injuries that he had and his inability to stay working, it led to a lot of financial hardships for the family, which of course in turn created a lot of marital issues between Jim Jones's father and mother.
Of course, always does.
Always does. In 1934, the Jones family was evicted from their home and their relatives purchased a shack for the family to live in on their property in the nearby town of Lynn. So Lynn, Indiana is where we are. The shack that was purchased had no plumbing, no electricity. And the family decided that in this community, they were going to try their hand at farming to try and earn an income. And then, of course, also to get food. Right.
Right.
But because of Jones's father's poor health, it didn't work out. They were not successful. They wound up relying very heavily on family members to help them out financially. And they often did go without any food.
Yeek.
It's reported that Jones's mother was not incredibly maternal and was not very caring of the young Jim Jones. And I mean, truthfully, was quite neglectful. Once he started school, she was forced to go back to work. So the family who had been supporting them said, hey, he's in school. You have no excuses. You don't have to stay home and watch him anymore. Now you have to go get a job.
Right.
So she went to work to try and supplement the income. But again, Jim Jones's father was in and out of the hospital, so that sucked a lot of those finances right back out of their bellies, basically.
Of course. Yeah.
And so Jim kind of adopted this behavior of like a feral child. He was like a wild child. He would wander the streets of town just on his own. Sometimes he would be naked. Just, he was literally a wild child.
Okay.
The aunts and uncles that were in the town would help to care for him as much as they could. There was families in Lynn that would bring him in to help provide food and clothing for him. And there was a woman who lived nearby, one of their neighbors. Her name was Myrtle Kennedy. She was the wife of the pastor of the Nazarene Church in town. She really took a liking to Jim and kind of took him in more than most. And she gifted him a Bible, and she encouraged him to study the Bible, that would lead him on the path of good. And this really brought him into his own, becoming really obsessed with religion.
Okay.
And as he grew older, he started to attend not just church services at the Nazarene Church, where Myrtle's husband was the pastor, but he would go to church with the Quakers. He would go to the Apostolic Church, the Methodists, the Baptists, you name it.
So he dipped in everything. He put his toe in everything.
All over town and all. He dipped his toe all over, holy water fountains all over town. Speaking of, he actually got baptized into multiple different religions as a child.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because he just became obsessed with the story of religion, kind of what it all meant. He showed interest very early at a very young age in becoming a preacher when he would get older. So he would actually hold his own services in their backyard, and he would preach to the local children, which of course didn't make him super popular amongst his peers. His neighbors were later quoted to say that he was an unusual child who was obsessed with not only religion, but also obsessed with death. He would regularly visit the local casket manufacturer in Lynn, and like, just, I guess, to ask questions, just to kind of see what the haps was at the casket shop. I don't know, but this was like, it was like part of that like macabre fascination that he had.
Okay.
He would also collect roadkill and hold mock funerals for the dead animals.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's strange.
Yes. Which of course led to reports of animal cruelty in order for him to hold these funerals.
Right.
That wasn't, corroborated by any specific thing, but of course this leads to those town rumors, right? That he Correct. Not only was collecting the roadkill, but he was doing the roadkill, right?
Right.
So obviously these strange practices stood out to the neighbors. They also reported that he misbehaved in different ways, more serious ways. He would steal candy from stores. And then of course his mom was left to then pay for what he stole, which again, on this limited amount of funds that were coming into the family, was not exactly great look.
No, not great at all.
He would casually use profanity, which became kind of like a thing throughout all of the stories of Jim Jones, like up until his death. He would pepper his sermons with vulgar language. Like it was just like as if he was saying the word "the" was F-bombing all over the place, which I mean, hey, you know, relatable, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
but he would greet his friends and neighbors by saying, "Good morning, you son of a bitch," or "Hello, you old dirty bastard." I mean, you know, it adds a little color to the day.
You know, it's his way of showing his endearment towards them. I mean, whatever.
I guess
it could be worse.
You old son of a bitch. But what's really interesting is this is apparently his mom would do this, and she would swear in public because she thought it was fun to see the reaction from other people to see like a female using profanity in public.
Because
of course we're talking like this is the 30s, right?
Right.
So it would get people all like clutch the pearls when she'd be like, "Oh damn it." And like she got enjoyment. So he kind of picked up on this and started to do the same.
Okay.
He also starts to develop an interest in very varied social and political doctrines. He was an avid reader. He would read books upon books. He would go to the library, read books, bring books home and read, and like just constantly keeping himself really engrossed in social issues, political issues. He studied Stalin. He studied Karl Marx. He studied Adolf Hitler.
Eesh.
And he also studied Gandhi. So like, again, like very like communist and then also Gandhi. Like it's like,
so again, he's dipping his toes into all the the things in every aspect of life.
Correct. It's, very like crazy. Little from column A, little from column B, and we'll see what we kind of come up with, right?
Yeah.
But he never really outwardly expressed a specific allegiance to any political view. So it wasn't like at this point, at least, he was outwardly saying, "Well, I am a communist," or "I am a this," right? It was just he really studied from across the board. But once World War II started, he started to really develop a deep interest in the Nazi party. He was fascinated by Hitler's ability to hold complete power and control over the soldiers that were under his command. And much to the disgust of the entire neighborhood, he would act as like a dictator over the other children that come over, and he would order them to march together in a style of the Nazi army and then would hit the kids that wouldn't listen to him and wouldn't march for him.
That's not great.
Not great.
Not a great look at all.
Not a good look. Tim Reiterman, who is a biographer of Jim Jones, he wrote that he believes Jones's attraction to religion was more than likely influenced by his desire for a family or some sort of semblance of community
and connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. His mom refused to discipline him even when neighborhood parents would ask her to, right? Even when he was misbehaving and becoming incredibly an incredible neighborhood nuisance, she would not discipline him. Many parents would keep their own kids away from him, which of course then turned him into quite the outcast. And by the time that he started high school, he was incredibly disliked by the other people in town, kids and parents alike. In high school, he would wear his Sunday best to school every single day. No matter what day it was, no matter what was going on, he was in his garb, his Sunday garb. Mm-hmm. His religious views continued to alienate him from his peers. He frequently would like yell at them and confront them for their adolescent behavior, drinking, smoking, dancing. So basically he was like a one man town from Footloose. Like,
wow.
No dancing, wow. Right? Like very like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, shit. Right.
I actually wrote down he was a one man town from Footloose, and I wanted to make sure I got to use that line because I was very proud of myself when I wrote
that, That was very good. I appreciated that
because that's kind of what he was. He would also like walk into dances and stuff and start to preach the Bible and insist that other young people would read the Bible with him. So, you know, again,
so
like
he's basically had this mentality to be a leader from day one,
and not just a leader like a dictator.
Right.
Beyond being a leader, right?
Correct.
Like, I'm a manager of a team, so I'm the leader, right? And it's like, it's beyond that. It's like a worship me. Mm-hmm. Everybody should follow me and have my same opinions mm-hmm. and outlook. And right, exactly. So yeah.
Agreed. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jim did not participate in sports because he hated losing, which again, like honestly kind of relatable, but also like sports suck. I don't like watching sports. I don't want to participate in sports.
Yeah.
So he didn't participate in sports, but instead what he would do is he would coach teams for younger kids. And I don't know if this was because it was challenging to him, or if he felt like if he had a younger audience, he would have more influence over the children.
Or maybe it was, he felt like he had power.
Power
he had
over
the upper
them,
hand.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Because now he's the coach, he's the leader,
correct.
Right? He's the dictator of these children. Correct. So he would coach teams for young kids.
Okay.
Jones was incredibly upset during one of the games that he went to. They were in Richmond, Virginia, and there was a group of attendees there that were Black, and they were being treated terribly by the other people that were there in attendance, and you know, the refs or whatever. And he was incredibly upset by this. The events at that game really brought to the forefront for him the reality of racism against people of color. And he began to have an incredibly strong aversion to discrimination, which, hey,
that's a good thing.
Check one box on something I have in common with Jim Jones, right?
Right. That's a really good thing. Like,
he's great.
Okay, Jim.
Now, interestingly, his father belonged to the Indiana branch of the Klan, which at that point was quite powerful, was quite large and, you know, influential in the town. Mm-hmm. Town was still pretty segregated. And, you know, even though it's in Indiana, it was very like Southern mm-hmm. mentality there.
Absolutely.
And Jones had once described an incident about an argument he had had with his father about race. And when Jim had brought one of his Black friends home with him, his father wouldn't let him in the house. And according to Jones, he and his father didn't speak for many years after that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So again, like, hey,
I mean, that's a good
thing. It doesn't erase all the awful things.
No, it does not. Exactly, but at least he had one good quality.
One good attribute.
One good quality.
So Mr. and Mrs. Jones, they separate and eventually divorce. It's about 1945. Jim moves to Richmond, Indiana with his mother. He graduated from Richmond High School in 1948. He actually graduated in December. So he graduated early. He graduated with honors. Teacher said that he was incredibly bright. And honestly, gotta say, I'm going to attribute it to all the reading he did as a child.
Oh, for sure.
No matter what the material was that he was reading, that's going
absolutely
to help you to have better comprehension of tasks and subjects. So, I mean, hey, again, another check in the good column. to support himself, he begins working at Richmond's Reed Hospital as an orderly. This is 1946. Mm-hmm. While he's there, he meets and begins to date a woman named Marceline Baldwin. She's a nurse in training at Reed Hospital when he's working there. A couple of years or not long after that, he moves to Bloomington, Indiana, November 1948. He attended Indiana University at Bloomington. His original intention, he wanted to become a doctor, did not stick with that for very long. But during his time at university, he was really kind of taken by and impressed by a speech that Eleanor Roosevelt had made about the plight of minorities. And he began to support communism and other radical political views publicly for the first time, based on what was said in the speech by Eleanor Roosevelt, who was not a communist, but I guess that's what he picked up from that. I don't know.
Apparently.
He read through the lines, I guess.
Right,
I don't know.
That's the way he
interpreted it.
Correct.
Ooh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So Jones and Marceline continue to date throughout his time in college, and the couple marry on June 12th, 1949. Now, Marceline was incredibly religious. She was brought up Methodist and was quite indoctrinated in her church with her family. And the two of them would often argue about religion. His big opposition to the Methodist church at this time was the church's practice of segregating races. Mm-hmm. And this caused a strain in their marriage from kind of the very, very beginning.
Yeah.
And throughout the duration of their lives together, he would emotionally, psychologically abuse Marceline. Part of this comes when he wants to decide that he's going to test her love and loyalty to him. Now, I want you to kind of like mentally asterisk this.
Okay.
Because this is going to come back at the end of the story.
Okay.
Next week. More next week. But he would test her loyalty by telling her that one of her close friends or a close family member to her had died. He would comfort her over the loss and then eventually tell her he was lying to like test her.
Wait, what?
Yes. To make sure that she was like, I guess like his comfort of her was to like trauma bond, but this is something that he did multiple times repeatedly.
But see, now here's my thing. Wouldn't you think that after a while she'd be like, okay, the boy who cried wolf?
Right.
Like,
but yeah.
Oh my God, that's terrible.
Terrible. Yeah, that's like sadistic behavior.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In 1951, Jim Jones is now 20 years old. He starts to attend meetings for the Communist Party in Indianapolis. And because of his now public alliance with the Communist Party, his family starts to become harassed by government authorities because they are now actively involved in the communist movement. Mm-hmm. He becomes incredibly frustrated with this prosecution that he feels is happening with him. And he once said that he asked himself, quote, "How can I demonstrate my Marxism? The thought was infiltrate the church," end quote. In 1950, yeah. Well, and you know what? It harkens back in my memory to a interview that was once given by L. Ron Hubbard, the mm-hmm. Founder of Scientology, mm-hmm. where he had said that the way that you become a millionaire is to start a religion. And I mean, he did. And
yeah.
It's an incredibly wealthy organization. Cult. Mm-hmm. Cult.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
excuse me. I had something mm-hmm. stuck in my throat. but it's very that, right? It's like, okay, well, how do I find power over people? How do I demonstrate my seemingly harmless but truly harmful want to have power over people? Oh, I know. Infiltrate the church.
Yep.
Right. So in early 1952, he announces to his wife and his family that he is going to become a minister of the Methodist Church. Okay.
Okay.
And he says to them that he believes that the church is really ready to put real socialism into practice. In the summer of 1952, he's hired as a student pastor to the children at the Somerset Southside Methodist Church. However, about 2 years later, he's fired from his position at the Methodist Church because apparently he was stealing funds from the church.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, later, of course, he claims that he left the church by his own accord because its leaders were forbidding him from integrating Black parishioners into the church. But it turns out he's a big fucking liar and he's actually just stealing money. So yeah.
Absolutely. And he was just using the segregation thing to kind of make it seem like
I'm a good guy.
Exactly. Exactly. It was his cover up story.
Exactly. Around this time is 1953. He visits a Pentecostal Latter Rain convention. Latter Rain is like a movement within the Pentecostal church. This is in Columbus, Indiana. And while he's there, a woman there prophesizes that Jones himself is a prophet with a great ministry. So he is incredibly,
he's that's all he needed to hear. That's like, all he needed to hear.
Correct. Like, talk about stroking the ego, right? So he's surprised, but of course is like, why, yes, I'll get up and preach to all of these people. So he gets up to the podium and he delivers a message to the crowd. Apparently it went over like gangbusters. Jones is like on his way to becoming a superstar in this Latter Rain movement. In 1953, he starts to attend and preach at the Laurel Street Tabernacle in Indianapolis, which is a Pentecostal Assemblies of God church. He starts to hold healing revivals. So these are the like laying hands on people and all of a sudden now they can walk again when they were in a wheelchair. And he does this for about 2 years and starts to travel and speak at other churches in the Latter Rain movement. But the Assemblies of God as an institution, the Pentecostal church as an overarching institution, was not vibing with the Latter Rain movement. Okay. So in 1955, they did put a new pastor at the Laurel Street Tabernacle who enforced the ban on these healing revivals, which of course led him to leave. And he establishes his own church, which is called the Wings of Healing.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And this new church would later be renamed the People's Temple.
Yep. There it is.
We have arrived.
Yes. Yes, we have.
Okay. So he starts to associate. He starts this church. He starts to associate with the Independent Assemblies of God, which is the IAOG. I'm going to call it the IAOG from now on. And this is a group of churches. It's an international group of churches that is focused on this Latter Rain movement. So the IAOG has incredibly lax requirements to make people ministers. Like very few, like, do you have a pulse? Do you believe in this?
Yeah.
Congratulations. You're a minister. Yeah.
There you go.
Kind of. Yeah. And they were also accepting of these healing rituals that he would do. In June 1955, he holds his first joint meeting with a man named William Branham, who was a healing evangelist and a Pentecostal minister. In 1956, he was officially ordained as an IAOG minister. And I mean, with haste was incredibly prominent within this IAOG organization. He actually organized and hosted his own convention, a healing convention, to take place at, it was June 1956 at the Indianapolis's Cato Tabernacle. So in order to entice crowds to his convention, he kind of like needed a gimmick. He needed a hook.
Of course.
So he invites this Branham, William Branham, Branham guy to come back. Cause he's like the tits in this Pentecostal movement.
Okay.
So Jones was like, oh, you the tits, you're going to be here.
You need to be here. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Yeah.
Correct. No ifs, ands, or tits about it.
I see what you did there. I appreciate I know that.
Okay. So Jones and Branham start to host these like joint meetings and assemblies. And he winds up getting an audience of 11,000 people their very first joint meeting. At this convention, Branham gets up and issues yet another prophecy about Jim Jones. He endorses him and his ministry. He says that God used this convention to like birth this new ministry of Jim Jones. Okay. And all of these people who were enamored by both Branham and then of course now Jones actually thought that the way that he performed throughout this convention meant that he had some sort of like supernatural gift. So between that of like healing, so between and the endorsement that he gets from Branham, People's Temple like blows up in its membership. He's particularly effective at recruiting the Black attendees at this convention. And according to the newspaper report, regular attendance at People's Temple swelled to 1,000 thanks to the publicity garnered from Branham giving like credence to Jones and the People's Temple.
Mm-hmm.
Through the Latter Rain movement, Jones becomes aware of a gentleman out of Philadelphia who goes by the title Father Divine. And he is a African-American spiritual leader of the International Peace Mission movement.
Well, with a name like that, I'd hope so.
Father Divine. Exactly. Yep. It's kind of like you were named after the job that you're going to get.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
You
got to live up to it. You know?
You got to live up to it. Your Father Divine. Well, okay then.
Yes.
Okay. So now his International Peace Mission movement was often criticized by the Pentecostal ministry or the overlords because Father Divine made the big mistake of claiming his own divinity, that he himself was divine, like godlike. Big no-no.
Yeah.
Big no-no. In 1956, Jones goes to Philadelphia because he wants to see what all the fuss is about with this Father Divine. And he winds up bringing back teachings that Father Divine is using, specifically on communal living. And he starts to implement a lot of like the outreach practices that he witnessed at the peace mission. So he sets up a soup kitchen. He provides free groceries and clothing to people in need. He also begins to implement the disciplinary practices that Father Divine employed, which started to really take control over the lives of the people who were part of the People's Temple.
Right.
So like, we're going to start to see those like culty characteristics take shape.
Yep.
In 1960, the People's Temple joined the Disciples of Christ denomination. This denomination of the sect of Christianity had its headquarters in Indianapolis. So it was close by. It was local. In both 1974 and 1977, the Disciples of Christ leadership received allegations of possible abuse at the People's Temple. So they did investigate, but in their investigations, they did not come across any wrongdoing. So whether it was people lying for the church or there wasn't any evidence of this abuse, they weren't able to come across with any wrongdoing. And the leaders of Disciples of Christ denomination found that the People's Temple to be, quote, an exemplary motherfucker, an exemplary Christian ministry overcoming human differences and dedicated to human services. Yeah. So yeah. In 1960, the Indianapolis mayor, Charles Boswell, appoints Jim Jones to a post within the community. And his new title is director of the local human rights commission.
Why?
Well, I mean, he was doing good things for integration. So, you know,
okay.
Now, Boswell kind of wanted him to keep a low profile, but of course, Jim
that's
Jones
not going
to
happen.
Nothing. He is nothing if not conspicuous, you know?
Correct.
So he decides to use this position that he has now been granted to go on local radio shows, local television programs, and preach about what's going on over the People's Temple.
Mm-hmm.
He was welcomed with cheers at a meeting of the NAACP and the Urban League. He encouraged his audience to be more militant, and he capped his speech by saying, "Let my people go."
Stop it. Stop it.
Sir.
Stop it.
Sir. Sir.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sir.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm all for being like an ally and a advocate.
Yeah, but
of a community that you're not a part of, but like, bro, like, can we not steal the phrasing?
No, don't do that. That's
just not a good look. Mm-mm. He's also like Jim Jones. Like, if it was anybody else, you'd kind of be like, oh my God, it's so powerful. But it's him, yeah, and you're like, this asshole.
That's no, no, no bueno. Right. Don't no do that. No,
let's not. You know what? Let's not and say we did. Actually, let's not and say we didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So during his time as the director of this commission, he did help to racially integrate churches, restaurants, the telephone company, even the police department.
Nice.
He also helped to integrate the theater, amusement park, and the Indiana University Health Methodist Hospital.
Okay, that could go in his good deeds column.
I know. It's like, oh, this guy.
Like, if he would have just stayed on that path.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Come on. Like, that's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
That's huge. And good on him. But it's again, huge,
baby. Yeah.
His cons outweigh his pros.
His cons. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cons are bad. The cons are real bad.
They're really bad.
Real bad.
The good are good, but the bad are fucking awful.
Awful. Despicable, one would say. Mm-hmm. So Jim and Marceline start to adopt children because they want to grow their family. And they adopt several non-white children. Mm-hmm. He refers to his household as his rainbow family.
Oh.
And then states, quote, integration is a more personal thing with me now. It's a question of my son's future, which again would be noble if it wasn't so conniving.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yes. In 1954, the Jones adopt their first child, Agnes, who was part Native American. In 1959, they adopt three Korean American children named Lou, Stephanie, and Suzanne. They also encourage temple members to adopt orphans from the war-ravaged Korea. It's around the Korean War, obviously. Yeah. War-ravaged Korea.
Yeah.
Korean War. Doi.
Context clues. Use them. Yeah,
exactly. I'm an idiot. Now, Stephanie, one of those children, she did die at 5 in a car accident, which...
Ooh, that's sad.
Fucking sad.
That's sad.
And not long after her death, he... and Marceline wind up having their only biological child, who they name Stephen Gandhi Jones.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
In 1961, they become the first white couple in Indiana to adopt a black child.
Okay.
And they name this child Jim Jones Jr. They adopt a white son whose original name was Timothy Glenn Tupper. And Timothy's mother was a member of the temple. Jones also fathers a child named Jim John.
Oh.
I know.
Okay.
Also with a temple member. Her name was Carolyn Layton. Now, and again, like I said, this was his rainbow family. He also referred to the temple as his like extended rainbow family. Mm. That was the vision. That was the goal.
Mm-hmm.
He, of course, another culty thing. Here's cult characteristic number two.
Mm-hmm.
While dictating the sexual lives of his members and saying who they could marry, who they couldn't marry, who they could have sex with, who they couldn't. He had numerous affairs with multiple women.
Of course.
He also said that he was the only truly heterosexual person on the planet. It was like a quote that he had. I don't understand. First of all, I don't understand like the study that had to be done to.
Okay, the results are in.
The results are in. And I am. Jones? Hold on. Let me find it. That is correct. The only heterosexual human on the planet. It is official. It's in the book. Oh, results God. Are in. Yeah. Okay.
I can't.
But then also, we'll get to it later. It happens later. Hold on. Okay. I think it actually happens later in this first episode. I don't remember where I put it in the story, but.
Okay.
We'll get there. But he's heterosexual. I just want you to kind of keep that in mind.
Okay. That's another asterisk. Okay.
A little mini asterisk. So
yes.
Psychological torture of his wife by testing her loyalty. He's the only heterosexual person on the planet. Those are the two things you need to keep in mind.
Got it.
In 1961, he starts his doomsday threats on the community. He starts to warn the congregation that he's had visions of a nuclear attack that's going to devastate Indianapolis.
Oh no. not Indianapolis. Only,
which, I mean,
out of all the places in the United States,
yeah,
Indianapolis.
Not that I want, let's no nuclear attack ever.
Oh,
no. Thank you.
No,
but I
never.
Just, of all the places that they could hit,
yep,
how convenient that it happens to be the city directly next to where the People's Temple is.
Correct.
Just saying.
Correct.
His wife confides to her friends that at this time he starts to become even more paranoid and fearful than he had been ever before. And he begins to look at how he's going to be able to escape where he is with his congregation still intact, because he wants to escape this destruction that he felt was like on the horizon, was coming to get him. Mm-hmm. Coming down the pike was this nuclear attack. Mm-hmm. In January 1962, he read an article in Esquire magazine that stated South America was going to be the safest place to live if a nuclear attack ever happened, a nuclear war ever broke out, that South America was going to be the, like, the haven.
Okay.
Again, I could look back and like check the work to see why they felt that way, but South America.
Okay.
Jones decides he's going to South America. He wants to scout for a site that he can relocate his ministry. He makes a stop on his way to Brazil. He makes a stop in Georgetown, Guyana. He started to hold revival healing meetings in Guyana, and they like fucking loved him there. He was a big hit in Guyana. Guyana at the time was a British colony, and they just like ate him up with a spoon. They do eventually, however, move, his family moves to Rio de Janeiro.
Yes.
In Brazil. And I felt like I didn't need to say it.
No.
Just in case.
Just in
anybody
case.
Thought I meant that he moved to watch the cartoon from the early 2000s called Rio. He didn't. He actually moved to Rio de Janeiro in the mid-1963. They wound up working with the poor in the working class and poor neighborhoods of Brazil. They're called favelas.
Ooh.
Favelas. Ooh. Probably said that really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize.
You tried. You did your best.
I did. I was going to say I wrote it phonetically, but like I literally said it like it's built. So
yeah.
I don't know if I wrote it phonetically. Favelas. anyway, unable to find a place that he really felt was truly like suitable for the People's Temple, he then started to feel guilt about like abandoning the movement back in Indiana.
Mm.
So, like, he was starting to make positive movements in the racial movement in Indiana, and he felt like by leaving he like pumped the brakes on that. Mm-hmm. Felt guilty. And during the year that he was gone, the attendance for the People's Temple plummeted down to like maybe 100 people, actually.
Oh,
less than
wow.
Yeah. On top of that, he was demanding of the People's Temple to send all of its money to him in South America to support his efforts. And then of course now the church is like fucking in debt because
right.
They're supporting him in Rio de Janeiro.
De Janeiro, yes.
De Janeiro. In late 1963, Archie I. James, who we're going to be hearing a lot about him, Archie I. James was, I don't want to put on him that he was like the right-hand man of Jim Jones. That's, I think, an unfair thing to say. I will say that he was, I guess, a trusted
or a confidant.
Yeah, a trusted advisor, pretty high up within the People's Temple.
Okay.
So Archie I. James, we're going to hear about him a lot. He reaches out to Jones and was like, hey, shit's bad here. Mm-hmm. Temple's about to collapse. Like, it's not good. And if you don't get back, I'm leaving. I'm going to resign.
Wow.
Like, get your ass back to Indiana. So he does. He comes back. He's reluctant, but he does come back. There are, like I said, horrible financial issues, low attendance. He winds up selling the building that housed the People's Temple and relocated to a smaller building nearby. Possibly to distract the members from like what's happening. He is saying that he did this and sold this in order for them to eventually now move out of the area.
Okay.
And he told the congregation in Indiana that the world is going to be overcome by nuclear war on, he gave an exact date, July 15th, 1967.
Hmm.
There is going to be a new socialist movement that is going to create an Eden in Northern California. So we need to go to Northern California because that is where this new socialist movement is going to be like birthed.
Okay.
We need to be at the forefront of this. So we are going to go to Northern California.
Okay.
And that's where we're going to end the episode.
Ooh, that's a cliffhanger.
That's where we're going to end the episode because this is where all of the rest of the cult characteristics start to rear their ugly head. It is a very fast decline from this point to the Jonestown Massacre. Within 10 short years, really bad fucking shit happens. And it all starts with him being able to relocate these members from one place to another. Which, and like, as we know, never go to that second location, right?
Right.
Yeah. So we're going to discuss next week Jones moving the People's Temple first to California and then eventually to Guyana, with, of course, keeping headquarters in both California and Indiana. Like, there's places all over the place now. And of course, the events that have led to the eventual massacre at Jonestown and some of its aftermath. So that is the end of part one of our Jonestown special. I don't know what to call that. Our very special Charlie's Cult Corner.
Yes. The Charlie's Cult Corner that we've been waiting for 3 years.
Yeah. It's kind of was the birth of the Charlie's Cult Corner, was me talking about how much I was obsessed with this.
Obsessed with Jonestown. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I concur.
So yeah. So
yeah. Holy shit.
That's your background. That's all your background information. So now you're kind of getting like, where did all of this like psychopathy come from with this person?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, his obsession with religion, his the neglect from a young age by his parents, his terrible relationship with his parents, his obsession with the ultimately noble desire to desegregate.
Mm-hmm.
But it like became this like obsession.
Yeah.
That became paired with. Yeah. Like he paired it with his like desire to lead and dictate and.
Yeah.
And it became incredibly dangerous. Yeah.
So. He turned this good thing into not so good.
He turned that upside down frown right back into a frown.
Yes. Like he did That's a 360.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's where we're going to leave you this week. I'm not going to do our whole sign off because this is a cliffhanger. We're going to see you next week.
Yes.
Thank you all so much for listening to part one. Come back next week for part two. We're going to be releasing it on Thanksgiving Day. And what could you possibly be more thankful for than more Charlie's Cult Corner?
Seriously. And you know what? It'll be a good thing to listen to when you're avoiding your family.
Yes.
Lucky.
Lucky you. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see y'all next week. But until then.
Sweet dreams.
This is Jonestown, Jonestown. It is coming, Jonestown.
Our theme song is the song Industrial Music Box by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.